Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington, and I'm hanging out with Elliot Gross today. How are you today?
I'm great.
Elliot Gross found the concept of financial independence at age 27 and put the plans in place a few years later. He has a family of five, and he's about 1.5 years away from retirement, even though just a few years ago, he was 35K in credit card debt. His wife and children are dual Italian citizens, which opens up opportunities for geo-arbitrage and travel. He's pretty active in the Choose FI St. Louis chapter and inadvertently house hacked his first home. And he's actually starting a podcast, which we'll chat about later with our mutual friend, Josh Epley. Today, we're going to focus on the FI journey, one more year syndrome, and how Elliot is thinking about when to retire, considering the FI community's, I guess, sort of, we're embracing the idea of like a higher safe withdrawal rate and spending more and generally not being as conservative. So a lot of stuff to cover today. And I'm curious, Elliot, like how did you initially find like the concept of FI and early retirement and that sort of thing?
My story is just like many others, Googling around when I'm at the lunch cafeteria one day of saying, hey, this really can't be what life is like. It's just going to work for 40 years and coming out with my gold watch at the end of time. There's got to be a better way. Insert Mr. Money Mustache, finding Pete's blog and really opened my eyes to the FI world.
And what kind of work were you doing then? Are you doing the same thing now?
I was working as a software developer at the time. I was working for a finance company. I do some different work now. I work still in technology and consulting.
Gotcha. And then many of our stories, Carl Jensen, he was having a very bad day at work, or maybe perhaps several years weren't going that great. And he was like, this kind of sucks. Where were you at sort of emotionally, psychology? Was it dark like Carl describes?
Mine probably wasn't quite as dark as Carl's was, but I mean, I think it's just feeling like being young in your career that you don't have, you're not being uplifted by the work that you're doing day in, day out. And so just came up to a point in my life where I was looking for something different, and I was very fortunate to stumble on Pete's blog.
And did you do anything immediately? Did you think this sounds legit, Mr. Money Mustache? And because some people, you know, they're like, that seems very early to retire at age 30. Does this really work out? That sort of thing. So what was your impression?
I mean, I'm sure people have been turned off by the face punches and riding bicycles and all the fun things, but I was able to, I think, read in between the lines of how much he's putting on a persona for his blog versus really the themes that he was speaking about. And to me, it did really resonate because, you know, we don't have to do all of these things and have these fancy cars or houses or vacations, et cetera. And along with that, I was working with a bunch of other software developers. We had my office at the time had catered lunch every day. So I was very fortunate in that fashion. So we had what we called developer lunchtime at 11 o'clock every day. And when I found it, I quickly said, oh, hey, look, everybody, like we found it. Like you can get the ticket out of here. And I'm sure probably you've had the same experience of that. I clearly didn't win over everyone at the table.
Yeah. Well, did you win anyone over? Because usually people are like, what the fuck are you talking about? I'm not in.
Yeah. So surprisingly enough, yes, there is actually probably two people that kind of caught on. One is actually early retired now and still lives in St. Louis. So yes.
Very cool. Yeah. I was trying to think back. I mean, when I kind of I came into things sideways. So I was doing like side hustle stuff. And I think I told a few people about that. And early on, I was like, hey, I made $300 this month, or I made $1,000. And my friends were typically like, say, 3 to 5 years older. So they were like, I don't really care about $300 or $1,000. Like, this doesn't make a difference to me. But of course, like, over time, and those dudes understood compound interest and stuff like that, but they didn't really think what I was doing was very interesting. And a handful of them I haven't talked to in a while. I'm actually getting together with a couple friends, and it'll be interesting to catch up because it's been about 5 years. And at this point, my wife Elizabeth is retired. I've really stopped working very much. So it'll be interesting to talk to them because we all have like IT type jobs, consulting and that sort of thing. So I can't imagine they're loving their job, although there's some weirdos out there, you know, there's a handful. Okay.
One of those early roadblocks that I would say I heard from my friends at that job was, well, I can't do this. I like my job.
They could just lie to themselves. I know. And that was just a joke, everyone. I know that some people do like their jobs out there. We hear from the three or four of you out there every now and then. So I know there's different jobs, but IT jobs, engineers, typically at some point we're like, oh yeah, we're shuffling papers. Like, this is not, we're not building new things. We're like updating old stuff. Yeah, it's a whole thing. Okay, let's move on here. So you discovered it, you were inspired, you tried to tell a couple people. So it sounded like it took a couple years for you to get things rolling. So what was going on? Like, why did you do anything immediately where you were like, you know what?
Sure.
I am going to calculate my net worth, but it took, you know, the wheels a little time to build momentum, that sort of thing.
I would just say that life was ongoing, right? I mean, I was definitely consuming all the articles back at the time. I think it was like 2014, you know, mint.com was alive and well. So I had kind of the budgets, not that I was strictly adhering to the budgets, but I at least had visibility of kind of where I was and had that concept of my network and how I was spending at least. The other meaningful thing that was going on at the time, right in that year, was I met my now wife. So that was probably dominating most of my time, was, you know, dating.
Cool. So we have a couple milestones that we'll bring up, and I'm going to jump ahead to the end of the story a little bit, and then we'll weave back in. So you're a year and a half away from retiring, and that's very exciting. Congratulations. I think you have enough time where, like, you can put some things into place. You could kind of, you know, you're starting the podcast, which I think is a good exercise just to like step away and work on another project. And I'm not one of the folks who, I don't think it's required to retire to something. I think that actually is a trap for certain people. It's great advice for some people, but like anything, it depends on who it is. So if you tell someone you have to retire to something, I think they could take that the wrong way. And anyway, the point is, you're about a year and a half away, and I'm curious, are you doing a handful of things like right now to get ready for it? How did you pick the 1.5 years for retiring? Sometimes people have a bonus on the way. Sometimes there's other things like that. So big question. I asked it the wrong way, but I'm leaving it open, and I'll ask some follow-ups when you finish.
So there is really some rationale for that timeline, and you already hinted at it. I do have bonuses and restricted stock units that mature around that time. And so it does kind of give me that super flow cash infusion right at that date. I think one of the biggest things that I have struggled a bit with is, I guess it's one more year syndrome more than anything else. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And is it literally, you're like, if we had just a little bit more, then this math works out a little bit better and it gives you a little more security, that the same idea everybody has?
So if anything, I feel like I have been fairly lean with my expenses as far as making sure I have tried pretty aggressively to make sure that I don't fall into one more year syndrome. And with that has come, you know, we've had people talk about you should retire 1 year less or use the 5% rule as opposed to the 4% rule and things of that nature. And so I just want to make sure, obviously, I don't cut it too lean.
Right. It's interesting. I was thinking about this, not in relation to our conversation, but I was walking Georgie and I was thinking back to like when I bought my first house and it was like a friend's father who was like, yeah, you should definitely buy more house than you think you need. You're going to be earning more money in the future and blah, blah, blah. That was like the end of 2005. It was like the height of the market in the Atlanta area. Turned out to be like dumb advice for me. The other part, stepping back now that I'm like 20 years older, I'm like, oh yeah, this dude was like the fucking COO of like a very, it's a huge company. So it's like his advice was not very, like maybe it's great advice for his son since they were affluent, but like I didn't have the same like whatever vacation homes and stuff like that. It's a little bit different advice for like someone who eventually like didn't like his job very much to take advice from like a COO of a very, very big company. It's like, I'm not the right audience. That said, I think it is probably good to acknowledge the one more year syndrome, but like if the timing is off, then it kind of sucks if you like quit and then it didn't all work out. Like the market's been up a lot over the last few years, over the last decade or so. It doesn't mean I don't think that's going to continue. I don't know what the future will be. But anyway, you get the point. So in that case, you're trying to acknowledge that. Is there any, like, what are you doing specifically? Just literally just like thinking about that and putting it through that lens?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think to go back maybe a little bit to your earlier question is, you know, not the retiring to something, but maybe a little bit of like, what would life look like when I do retire? And somebody challenged me with that, you know, a number of times. And so trying to look at what does my life really look like if essentially money is no matter anymore. So things to me was working out, taking care of my physical health, eating healthy in that regard, doing some sort of, I would say still, quote unquote, work, even though it may not be paid work. I know Diana Merriam had a post about that pretty recently. And just how, I mean, I think that's a common problem that a lot of retirees, regardless of whether or not they're in the FI community or not, have. And then having, make sure that you're leaving time for, I put practicing a skill. So I'm trying to learn Italian right now, try and be a better cook, maybe pick up an instrument, have social outings, and then play with my kids, hang out with my wife. That's what a perfect day looks like to me.
Nice. Very good. So I'm jumping around quite a bit here, but I do want to go back to the 35K in credit card debt. So can you put the time frame around this and describe what that was for and then the progress of erasing that debt?
I guess it would have been right before 2011. It was right before I purchased my first house. So I was fortunate enough and privileged enough to exit college being actually in the black as opposed to the red. My parents helped me pay for college. Or I shouldn't even just say helped. They pay for my college. You know, I think I took maybe one loan in the entirety of my career. I did always have internships and co-ops as part of just engineering background that I was getting paid a decent salary for my age and my experience. But I left college, I think, 40K in the black. Obviously set up pretty well. I had a job exiting college, even in January of 2010, you know, end of the financial crisis, et cetera, but put a down payment on a house eventually. At the time I was engaged, and so my fiance and I were buying a house, but I had gotten really into Magic the Gathering again. That was a game that I had played a lot when I was younger. And so I had built up quite a collection. We're talking tens of thousands of dollars. And part of this was I had a local business owner that had asked me for a loan. Given the fact that I had an engineering job that was paying me a decent salary, you know, I was there all the time. I was like, yeah, sure. You know, no problem. I got money laying around, essentially. Fast forward very quickly, saw that I wasn't going to get repaid that loan. So that kind of snowballed some of that. In addition to that, I would say I also had, you know, being a young 20-year-old, I was going to the bars or buying my friends, you know, meals or whatever.
Right. Man. That's a lot. I never played Magic, but I had friends that did. And I'm just thinking of all the guitars that you can get for a few tens of thousands of dollars. It's crazy. Do you still have such a collection?
No. So I've actually sold out of my collection three separate times. So to put it in perspective, I mean, I think the collection at the height was probably about $40,000 worth of cards, but there was one card that I always use as kind of that barometer of how the price changed. So when I sold it the first time, it was worth $25. When I sold it the next time, it was $125. And when I sold it the third time, it was $250.
Gotcha.
So all you want to know about Magic the Gathering.
Yeah. Well, I don't really want to know much at all, but I know there's the audience has a high percentage of nerds. All right. So no offense to y'all. I'm also a nerd, but just in a different way. So what card was it? Because there's a handful of people that actually will give a shit. So like, tell us what card it is. People can leave comments and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So tell us a little bit more about it. Go a little bit deeper.
So that card that I just referenced in that example was a Underground Sea, which is a dual land from the revised edition.
Okay. And then I'm also curious, a lot of times we see 80-20 play out. Were there just a few cards that were like worth the majority of it? Or was it just like a very large number of cards that were worth like $200 or whatever?
It was, in my example, I had just, quite frankly, a lot of cards. And so it was kind of I guess cell phones were around, but it wasn't like everybody had their true pocket PC. And so trading card games used to be kind of based upon, well, knowing the value of the card as it fluctuated in time. So
got it. All right.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. We'll shift gears. How many kids do you have and how old are they?
Yeah, I've got three kids. They're getting ready to have birthdays here in September, but they are carry the two. They are 6, 4, and 4.
Okay. 6, 4, and 4. Twins in there?
Yes. Twin boys. And then I have a daughter who's 6.
Okay. All right. So your hands are full overall.
Yes. Yes, they are.
All right. So one other thing I want to hit on before we talk about like getting, I guess, really started with your plan and moving towards early retirement. You mentioned that you had a bit of a roller coaster ride. So we talked about the debt a little bit. You mentioned, I think it was a very unfortunate week some years ago. And I want you to tell that story.
I go into some more depth in this in my origin story on our podcast, 9 to 5, but real briefly, the tagline is I had a job loss, I totaled my car, I got shingles, and I had a broken engagement in the span of a week and a half. So it was a tumultuous week and a half, to say the least.
Yeah, can you expand a little bit?
At the time, I was working for a management consulting firm. I was going into work for a software deployment at 4 a.m. in the morning at our client site, and we had to be on site back in the day. So I had to drive to downtown, do our coding and deployments and all the things. And then actually, upon leaving my job, I suspect it was a drunk driver, but somebody basically came into my lane when I was getting onto the highway and basically ran me into the road, or like into the guardrail. So my paid in full car got totaled. Rest in peace, Acura TL. And so yeah, that obviously wasn't great. I think due to all of the stress that brought on, I managed to pick up shingles. So I think at the time I would have been, it was either 25 or 26. And so, yeah, I got my quarter life crisis kind of ticked off. And then, yeah, I was put on a PIP at work, and that's a performance improvement plan, just honestly, because my job wasn't real taxing. So I wasn't the model employee, I would say, at the time.
Gotcha.
And then the crown jewel was my fiance and I at the time were doing long distance, and ultimately we ended up breaking the engagement.
Gotcha. Man, yeah, that's a hell of a week. With the performance improvement plan, how'd you feel about that? It sounded like maybe you're an overachiever type. We've established you're a nerd already. So yeah, how did that hit you?
Hard, I think, is the most succinct way of putting it. But I had the job or title of technical architect, and in that specific role, my job was basically to prepare the development environment for developers to do their testing in each and every day. So my grand total of work was probably about half an hour, if I had to guess, in an 8-hour day. And so it wasn't real taxing. So after I finished my 30 minutes worth of work, I don't know, I didn't apply myself probably as well as the company would have liked at that time.
Yeah. Interesting. When we finish recording, I'm curious what company
that yeah, was. Yeah. No, it's interesting. I think you'll get a good laugh out of the company name.
Yeah. And by the way, I don't know what it is, but I was going to say, because you're in the St. Louis area, I worked at a company called Amdocs, which you probably know because they have a very large office there. Yeah. Great people. I liked many of the folks, but yeah. IT and management consulting around the same years. And it's a big employer, and we worked with big clients. So perhaps there's overlap. Okay. Anyway, moving on here, age 27, discovered Phi. You were still in your 20s, of course. So it took a few years to get things in place. So tell us about that portion of it. So it took a little while to get things in place. And then, you know, it's about 10 years later, like, you're like, I'm going to retire before too long.
I'm clearly a little thick-skulled if I didn't see Pete's shockingly simple math and just see the light. But I say that all in jest. But yeah, I mean, I think part of this was I was courting my now wife. At the time, I did have a house from that previous relationship. I still went through with that purchase. And so that's actually how I inadvertently fell into house hacking. I got roommates later, but kind of in that time of really 2014 to when I really put it into practice, I was working my normal job as a developer at the time. My wife and I got together in 2014 and started dating. By 2016, we bought our first house together. And I guess slightly before that, we had already started talking about. We were already engaged and, you know, combining finances, all of those kind of big conversations that you have as you're preparing to get married. We had decided to start paying off my wife's student loans. So she had some loans from both her undergrad and grad school. So we tackled those together before we were married. We got married in 2016. And then actually, I got money offered from my employer to pursue advanced degrees. So I went and got an MBA, and that concluded in 2017. And then I would say 2018 was the year that my first child, my daughter, was born. And I think that was really probably the impetus to say, hey, it's time to get really serious about this. No more just casually looking at it on Mint, but let's put it into practice.
Going back just a little bit, you were making good money and you were doing some responsible things, conceivably, right? So you got some roommates, so that helped out. Were you contributing to like 401k and Roth and that sort of thing, but you weren't like pushing hard? Where were you like in those early days?
Yeah, in the early days, it was much more kind of focused on, I guess I would give the analogy of the blocking and tackling. When I got that first house, that would have been 2011, making sure that I could obviously handle a house payment by myself. It very quickly was like, I mean, I can, but I don't exactly want to. At the time, I had been working at a rock climbing gym in addition to my full-time gig at one point. And I had asked, hey, does anybody need a roommate? Know of anybody that needs a roommate? And quickly met a friend of one of my coworkers at the rock climbing gym. And we became roommates the very next day. Was someone that was graduating from college and needed a place to live, and just kind of worked out.
Gotcha. How long did you have that roommate?
So that was all the way from 2011 to 2016. So they quote unquote got their eviction notice once my wife and I bought our combined house, and I sold the old house to.
And then what'd you do with the money, right? So I actually had a roommate for, I can't remember, maybe 3 years or so, something like that. Mm-hmm. It could have been one. I have no idea. I can't remember 20 years ago, right? I went to the bars and like ate out and what? Yep. I basically wasted it. I could have done something a little bit better, like actually much, much better, like pay off. I mean, I financed a whole house, right? It was like I put more down on the car that I bought than I did on the house. Yeah. So what'd you do with that money?
Sounds like we're kindred spirits here because, I think I would be retired if I actually did what I should have done. But in jest, because not only did I get that first roommate, I eventually got a second roommate, and I even had a third roommate that I was like a really close personal friend, and I didn't ever charge him rent. But yeah, in short, I wasted it wooing my wife into, hey, we should go out to eat and go to the bars and do all the things.
That said, I mean, part of the theme of our conversation is just like, it's okay to spend a little bit more money. And like, we really enjoyed those times in our 20s because it was pretty fun. I probably should have traveled a little bit more, but I traveled a decent amount, so I don't know. Everything turned out fine. All right. So you mentioned something earlier, which is very smart, profound. You said as you and your wife were about to get married, you started talking about finances. You're like, people should do that. It's like, they should. Most of us don't. Like, my wife and I did not. It was several years in, and we actually still butt heads on how we approach money. She's far more organized and a lot more conservative than I am. But were you and your wife both on board, like sort of right away, like, hey, let's bring up these conversations?
So my wife's name is Dawn. Dawn and I were very much on the same page right away, is that we felt like to really be 100% in on a marriage, that there wasn't a separation of finances, is that we're treating all of this money as our money. And so her debt's my debt, my money's her money, her money's my money, you know, all, it's all one and the same. And so I viewed that as, hey, we're making a serious commitment to each other. So, hey, I don't care that I didn't take out those loans. To me, that's just part of being a good partner.
Okay. So both on board right away. What about the FI portion and more aggressive saving and that sort of thing? Was Dawn also on board with that stuff?
Yeah. I think once we finally made the transitioned away from probably going out to eat as frequently as we did and trying to see what are we actually saving for? What are we prioritizing? And once it was certainly me that kind of turned Dawn on to FI, but explained like, hey, I've read these articles. It sounds like a really good thing. What do you think? She was immediately receptive, and that makes all the difference.
Is Dawn still working currently? Are there plans to retire soon after you or anything like that? Or what are the plans?
Yeah. So Dawn's career has kind of changed as our life has changed. Before my daughter was born, she was working. She is a social worker by trade. And so was doing that. Upon returning from her maternity leave, she put in her notice and then started working. She opened her own private practice to give herself more flexibility, moved to part-time. And then upon my twin boys being born, moved to a stay-at-home parent. She's ambitious, much more than I am. And so she has since started up her own business. So she started doing fresh cut floral business out of our house. And now she's kind of moved or pivoted a little bit to doing bridal floral arrangements.
Oh, cool. And then as a self-employed person, she could work as much or as little as she wants to. Is that kind of the idea?
Yeah, absolutely.
And because of that, she's probably fine to keep doing whatever she wants as much as she wants. That's the main idea.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I've told her so many times that she doesn't have to feel obligated to do anything. Like, obviously, having three kids is certainly a job in and of itself. But yeah, this is definitely a passion for her and something that she really enjoys.
Very cool. And I mean, it's tough to get a business started like that. Can you, obviously, I should ask Dawn, but can you talk about like starting the business and like getting clients and delivering and challenges along the way? Any stories come to mind?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think part of it was really born out of around COVID time that she really found that she had a passion for gardening and so really enjoys flowers. And so that was planting just at our own house and wanting to, I would say, beautify our own property. And then her brother was engaged and asked, would Dawn actually do the flowers for their wedding? And so obviously that's a big ask. She took that on as a challenge. And so that was a great opportunity to know that she had this big project that she was essentially working towards, but then along the way of honing her craft. So she was doing, you know, bouquets where she was harvesting straight from our yard and selling, you know, locally. So whether that's posting to Facebook groups or, you know, she's taken different classes of other people that have this, you know, skill to kind of build up to work towards that big first wedding. And so now really her pivot has now been, how do you get, you know, from that first wedding to more and more weddings? So at this point, I think she's got five or so weddings under her belt with, I think, another three or four booked for this year. So,
okay. That's awesome. Yeah, it's great to work for yourself. So one thing I didn't check with you beforehand, and it's okay if you punt this, but basically people will love to hear what expenses are for other folks. So if you can share exactly how much your annual expenses are, people are usually interested. If you don't want to share that, it's totally okay. But I'll pose the question because people want to know that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I'm completely open to sharing. I think that's the best way that really that transparency allows all of us to kind of get better and see what other people do. So I will say that our expenses are lumpy, just like everybody else's. So I think last year we spent like $114,000, but we also bought a car and put a new deck on our house, which were huge expenses that don't happen frequently. What I would say is our projected, I use kind of like a budgeted expenses, is right around between 85 and 90 K a year.
I guess I could do the math. So the car, the car and the deck, roughly 20 K.
So yeah, it probably, I bet we spent even more than 114, quite honestly. I know our deck was right around 20, 25, and the car, I bought a Tesla to make use of the tax credits. So I think it was in the high 30s.
All right. Which Tesla did you decide on?
I got a Model 3 at the time.
Okay.
Yep.
Got it. How do you like it?
It's been great so far. I mean, say what you want about the person in charge. Yeah. Otherwise, the product is good. So
people seem to like it. Whichever one they decide on, most people seem to like it. Although I haven't talked to anyone with a Cybertruck. I don't know if they like this, but okay. Very good. So expenses are a little lumpy, but it seems like you have a pretty good handle. And I don't know. Can you talk about the expenses? Like, has it been stable for years? Did you just go back and like look at credit card statements and like through analysis of the last few years, you're pretty confident on what things are going to cost?
I'm pretty meticulous with it, probably more so than I need to be. And so I have been tracking, when I say like 2019 was the year that I started in earnest following, I think what that meant to me is that I was nose deep in a spreadsheet at that point. And so I have records for, I mean, even balances of my 401k, IRAs, et cetera, all the way down to transactional level details to January of 2019. Obviously, as additional family members have entered the picture, things continue to change, but yeah, seems pretty good.
All right. And then how much is Don involved in that meticulous record keeping?
Yeah. So that was actually one of our initial episodes of our podcast, 9to5, as well, was kind of money dates and talking to your partner about this. And so in short, she's really not. She's not interested in the spreadsheets and everything else. You know, I disappear on the first day of the month and do all my calculations. And then really the first question I always ask her is, all right, what was our savings rate, this month? And she'll probably roll her eyes at me, but I mean, she cares, but not to the level of, care that I do, I guess.
Yeah. And it's good for people to have their thing too. Like, you don't need everyone to do everything all the time.
100%.
I don't think. Although Elizabeth would want that sometime. So you're about a year and a half out from retiring, and some people end up with almost all of their net worth in tax advantaged accounts. We're talking Roths and 401ks, traditional IRAs, that sort of thing. And there's a challenge to access that money. So with Elizabeth and I, about 10 years before we were even like able to retire, basically we started putting a lot of money in post-tax brokerage accounts, which while we don't have the tax advantaged situation and the pre-tax advantage, you have a lot of flexibility. And that's worked out great for us, even though the returns are a little bit lower technically. Things are fine. Everything worked out fine. So where's your net worth allocated? Can you talk about that a little bit? Are you able to access things
Sure.
when you need to?
Yeah. So I would say it's going to be close to having everything in really that optimal place, right? Is I would say we also kind of fell into the trap of having too much in those tax advantaged accounts early. We do intend to do Roth conversion ladder and kind of that traditional early retiree kind of mad scientist strategy. I'm lucky in that I do work in a highly compensated job. And so being able to kind of turn off valves of saying, hey, let's stop diverting so much just purely into pre-tax and let's just shovel money into post-tax as quick as possible. If we have to use some other strategies to get there, you know, so be it. But I would say we have roughly $250,000 in our taxable right now.
Okay. Gotcha. And then the other thing, so you shared some of your exact expenses. Are you able to share your net worth? And again, you could punt this and say, I want to be more private. But if you want to share it, your podcast co-host, Josh, he did share it. And people really enjoy that.
Yeah. No. So where we are today is 1.52 million in net worth, inclusive of the house and liquid, just shy of 1.3.
Very good. And with Josh, and people could check out his episodes, which came out recently, but Josh and Lori have a decent amount of their net worth in real estate. And it sounds like you, because we haven't mentioned it so far, it sounds like you don't have any real estate and you kind of followed, you know, the route of many software engineers and consultants where you just kept working, you were paid well, so you went that route. Is that accurate? Any other real estate, any other assets out there?
Correct. I'm pretty vanilla when it comes to assets. Is just put it in the market and let compounding do its thing.
And then that said, so you talked about the allocation and you said 250 in post-tax, mm-hmm. which will get you a little ways, but you have a lot that you will need to move over time. Will you need to access your pre-tax retirement accounts sooner, or will you be relying on Don's side income to cover costs? Can you just talk about that? Because like $250,000 is not nothing, but that's not enough for, I mean, you're a young man, so
sure.
It's not enough.
Yeah. Yes. I will say that my bonus and my RSUs are pretty heavy. I get 27% of my salary as a bonus paid every February. So that is nearly, I mean, it ranges on company performance, but it's 50 or 60 grand a year. So basically with that year and a half, I'm timing it as that's another 100 grand or so. I have RSUs that mature in March every year. So that's, you know, tens of thousands of dollars as well. But yes, if I have to bridge, then it would be either taking on some employment, you know, depending on where Don's work really is at that point in time. I used to be a home brewer, so I've got a inkling in my mind, like would I go work at a bottle shop or work at a brewery or something like that, just as more of a passion play. I don't know. We'll see when we get there.
And of course, there's other options too. I mean, you literally could like take a penalty and like do it that way. But there's a 72T, you know, for people that aren't familiar, talk to professionals. But basically, if you were like, hey, I just want to move over some money so that you can get whatever, $15,000 a year, just to cover like a small amount, you can do that. And that'll cover you for a little while. Again, talk to your professionals. This is just entertainment, folks, but there's options where it's not super complicated. You can figure it out and you'll know that you need to go grab that money. So, and again, a year and a half away, we're recording this in early September of 2025. So that's two rounds, basically, it sounds like, is what the plan is. Now, one thing I'm curious of, you're telling us how long. Do you have any concerns your company, are you so valuable that your company is not going to give a shit? I mean, a lot of people listen to this show, so it's probably going to make the rounds.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that I'm certainly taking a risk at putting it out there. And if they so elect to let me go, then maybe I'm just using this as my own impetus to say, all right, I've had enough of corporate America. I'll go figure it out in another way. But I think that I've been silent long enough where I'm just like, I'm going to let the chips fall where they don't fall and kind of move on.
Yeah, that's cool. Who knows? I mean, a lot of people do listen to the show. I don't know. Okay, very cool. Thanks for sharing all that info again. It's one of the most requested things. And typically, I mean, obviously, like Elizabeth and I don't share our numbers. We're a little more private. Elizabeth is a lot more private, but I appreciate you doing that. And again, people find this super fascinating, and I'm glad we buried it 50 minutes into the podcast.
That's right.
You really got to put in the time. So, all right. Any other details about like how you're like viewing specifically the finances, where we've talked about the allocation, you looked at your expenses, you have young kids, are you saving for their future education or kind of waiting to see how that may turn out?
Yeah. So there's lots of different levers that we can kind of pull because of kind of the unique situation that we're in. So my wife spent time to achieve gaining Italian citizenship. So she was able to do that by proving lineage to her great-grandfather who immigrated from Italy. And at the time that was the rule in Italy. I think they have actually since changed some of the laws around that. And so it's not as easy to do, but that was like a 7-year long process. But in doing so, the rule is once you are an Italian citizen, everybody related directly by blood can achieve it through you. And so all of my kids immediately got it after we were able to apply. And I also have a path to citizenship as long as I pass a fluency exam.
Okay, cool. So what does that do for you? Would you be able to move there? Can you talk about how that impacts expenses, just daily life, that sort of thing? Have you traveled over there much?
Yeah, let me first answer your previous question a little bit better. So I have 529s for all of our kids. I would say that we are not trying to overfund those by any means. There are now new paths and new laws that have allowed unused funds in those to go into, like, I think it's a Roth IRA or other ways of getting access to that money. But whether our kids choose to go to school here in the States or what that does allow them to do, being Italian citizens, is they could go and live anywhere in the EU, and theoretically, based off of when they go there, then could apply to go to school there as well.
Interesting. And then if are you guys looking to relocate to Europe or Italy in the future, or it's just an option that you potentially have?
Yeah, it's certainly an option. So we spent a little over a month there this year for the first time as an entire family. So that was a great experience. We were able to go. I mean, we went to 5 countries when we were throughout Europe, but spent the bulk of our time in Italy. And so, you know, I think it just opens the door to allow our family to go see, hey, you know, our kids are so young. We would love for them to be able to pick up language or see that there's other cultures besides just the US, to be determined, I think.
Yeah, it's cool to have the option. And then you're working on Italian. Does your wife already speak Italian?
She does not. she's actively learning to speak it as well, but she was born here in the States as well.
Are you guys studying together? Are you getting tutors? Are you taking classes? Like, what are you doing?
Yeah. So she's taken more formal classes. I think probably just somebody that offers, you know, speaking Italian in a local kind of Italian district within St. Louis. I've done the whole Duolingo. Probably I need to do something much more formal than that. But I've been doing that for almost 2 years now. So at least I feel like I'm getting a lot of exposure. And that is something that certainly in retirement, more than anything else, once I do truly have that time freedom to put in that level of effort to truly master a language.
I want to shift gears a little bit as we're coming up towards the end of time here. So you're pretty active in the ChooseFI local group in St. Louis. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Can you talk about how that has influenced your path here?
Yeah, I have been going to the local chapter. I know, obviously, our good mutual friend, Kristen Knapp, is our kind of ringleader in St. Louis. But I've actually been going to the chapter prior to Kristen reigniting it. And it used to be that we would just kind of go to a local microbrewery. You'd stand around, drink your beer, have some fries, and a lot of time you would just kind of give your same elevator pitch of who you are and why you're here. And that got pretty old pretty quick. So that coupled with COVID, and the guy that was kind of running our group actually relocated to Florida, St. Louis kind of died for a while. And so Kristen and Gwen Joyner, who I'm sure you know, and Amanda kind of spearheaded relaunching the group. And so now that coupled with really Diana Merriam's case studies that they were doing in Cincinnati has really reignited our group. So we meet twice a month, one as a case study and one as a social outing to kind of meet people where they are.
Cool. And that, since you were going before, I mean, you guys were on the path anyway, so you were looking at this. How helpful is it to have the group to go to versus a lot of people, maybe they haven't gone to a meetup yet, or maybe they haven't found a group around them that is meeting up. So a lot of people are doing this online. We listen to podcasts, they read blogs, YouTube channels, whatever, but it's all at a distance and you don't actually like sit face to face with people. So did that encourage you even more, just having the group around you?
Absolutely. I mean, I think I remember when I went to the Playing with Fire documentary. And like I said, my gateway into Fi was Mr. Money Mustache. And so I went and saw the documentary, and I had never listened to ChooseFI before seeing that documentary. Like, I remember I think it was like the intro music played for ChooseFI and the whole theater is kind of roaring. And I'm like, what is going on? Like, this this is very strange. Why do I not know this? And so I've since followed Brad and Jonathan and listened to everyone. But the difference in being in person versus just being on a blog or, you know, a podcast, et cetera, is really meeting other people that do this on a day in, day out basis. And I remember when I first met five people in my St. Louis chapter, it was seeing, okay, you know, like we talked about, Josh does real estate, and hearing people that do those strategies. You've got people like me that are all just in the market. We even had in the early days more of like a mastermind group that we just did that was like three or four people to just be accountable to somebody else that isn't just you. So you don't feel quite so isolated, I guess.
Right. Very good. Yeah. And it's been, I mean, here in Longmont, very lucky. Like, I'm going to potluck later tonight, and it's, you know, it happens every week. So it's like totally optional. But yeah, I think like being close and like for Elizabeth in particular to see people that are really retired and how they spend their time and that sort of thing. And they've been retired for like 5 or 6 years, or in Pete's case, like 20 years, that sort of thing, which as we are wrapping up, we're going to compress this a lot, but like you have a family and that takes a lot of time, right? Like you basically can just like work out, prepare food, record your podcast with Josh occasionally and spend time with the family. And that like takes up all your time. Are you concerned at all on how you're going to spend your time? You have a year and a half, but some people are like, oh, I don't know what I would do if I'm not working. What are you going to do?
I think at one point in time, I had kind of that existential crisis, like maybe some people have, is like, oh yeah, if money were no concern, what would you do? And you kind of just look blankly back at that person. But I've spent time really thinking about it and trying to plan that intentional day of just figuring out what's important to me and then trying to make sure that my actions really align to those core principles. So things like health, family, skills, doing some good in the world, whatever that means to you, and then ultimately just enjoying your time.
Very good. All right. So you have a podcast, 9 to 5. So people should be able to find several episodes out by the time this thing airs. So we'll link up so it's easy for people to find it. But can you tell us who this podcast is for? Who's the intended audience out there?
I would say our intended audience, Josh and I are just kind of two random guys that found Phi in our lives. We've gone through some hardship. I would say that Phi is truly meant for anybody that embraces the principles. And so we're just trying to have normal conversations that hopefully are relatable to you. We both come from families that are a little bit larger. We have multiple kids. So I would say that's a little bit of a different voice than maybe we hear quite so frequently in the Phi community.
Very good. And it's in all the podcast players. Is it on YouTube as well?
It is on YouTube, on Spotify, you know, Apple, all the things.
Perfect. All right. Awesome. So we'll link up so people can find you there. Is there anywhere else that you want people to go and check out your stuff, Elliot?
Sure. We do have a website. You can sign up for a newsletter. I don't know if we're ever going to do a newsletter, but we have the ability. So if you're so inclined, our website is 9to5pod.com.
Perfect. Elliot, this has been really fun. And like I said, we'll link up so people could find the new show. And we talk about it a little bit more in the sound check, which will be coming up in a moment here. So thanks a lot. And yeah, looking forward to checking out your show. Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Phi podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do 3 things for us. Number 1, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number 2, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number 3, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. You started recording your podcasts in the last few weeks. How's it going so far?
Yeah, it's been great so far. We just published our first 5 episodes that are out there on YouTube and Spotify, and soon to be all the major platforms, but going great.
Awesome. And any surprises in the first few episodes? What, like, was it tough to record the first one? Like, did you think, what right do I have to record any of these?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it is, and I will very openly say that the first one that was even just like 2.5 minutes long probably gave Josh and I the most paranoia. You know, it's very scripted. We sound super robotic, but I think everybody who's ever started a podcast knows that you just have to get through that first one. Those first few episodes aren't going to be your finest work, but you got to start moving.
You know what, man? One thing I forgot to tell you guys, you'll be fine, by the way. After you record about 100 episodes, you'll start to get a little bit more comfortable. So it takes a while. But one thing I forgot to tell you guys, and actually Carl and I did this, we recorded maybe 5 episodes or so. We released them out of order. So our first episode is one, like, we already had a few hours under our belt by then. So we kind of reshuffled things in that way. If people, some people go to the very first episode, they listen to the first one and see what it's all about. So if people do that, at least we had a few hours under our belt. So you can actually, like, probably in your podcast player, like, reshuffle the dates or whatever, and then re-record it and, like, all right, we're better
now. Try number two. Yeah. Because actually I inadvertently had them out of order on Spotify is I hit publish for all 5 at the exact same time. And so then it was like, oh, random. 3, 1, 4. Yeah. It's like, cool.
What are the topics for the first few episodes?
Yeah. So it's just really an intro of broadly what the show is going to be like. Then Josh and I each kind of give our own origin stories and how we found out about Phi and our own money habits, etc. Then we started talking about, I would say, evangelizing about the Phi movement, and then finally kind of money dates and relationships and how that kind of plays. Because yeah, Josh and I both come from a little bit larger families and have partners like that. So
got it. Interesting. And we'll probably mention it in the episode, but if people are thinking, oh, maybe I want to start a podcast, but there's too many out there, it doesn't really matter. I think it's a valuable thing to work on, because you have to hopefully clarify your thoughts before you're saying them out loud. And then even if, like, you don't have many listeners, or it's a couple dozen plus your family or whatever, that's totally fine. That's still a decent number of people. And I think the exercise of, like, recording something is worthwhile, or writing it or whatever, like if people want a blog or that sort of thing. But I think it's a fun thing to work on. And like many people, you guys were just talking and you were like, these are really great conversations. You felt like probably excited afterwards. And then you were like, we should record these. Is that pretty much what happened?
Yeah. Josh and I met at Economy in 2024. We didn't even know each other, despite being in the same room from Choose Phi local group meetings, and just kind of hit it off.
Very cool. Did you have, like, a seed planted, like, when you guys first met on, like, maybe doing a podcast, or it was like that was after you hung out a few times and had those conversations?
Yeah, it was definitely after having more conversations and just, you know, building really a friendship. And then eventually over time was like, hey, like you said, we should just hit record and see what happens.
Very cool. Yeah. Yeah. It's like dating, you know, if you were just, you met at a thing and then you went on a couple, you know, in air quotes, like, podcast dates